Well, hello, friends, enemies, everybody out there. This is a proof of concept. Talked to the Delaware liberal guys. We wanted to put some audio down and talk to you people. We also wanted to get Big Al Massetti back on the airwaves. Everybody's been asking for it and begging for it. So here we are. We're going to do the blog on audio. So I'd like to introduce to you the man from Arden, El Sam. He's going to run this thing. And REV, I'm just going to sit back and yell at you people.
This is the first podcast of DelawareLiberal.net. For now, we're calling it In the Belly of the Beast because we are indeed in an undisclosed location, in a concrete-lined bunker, surrounded by one percenters. Oh, baby, it's no possible to leave in a lie, to leave in a lie. I guess it's not logical to say so right.
Comrades and friends, hello. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Here's what we're doing today. Next week, we're going to be celebrating. I call it celebrating. I think that's fair to say. Our 300th episode. And a lot of this has to do with Carl's perseverance of not wanting to miss a week, which we have not done. In reverence to this time, we'd like to talk about sort of the history of it and some of our own sort of reflections on why we were able to do some of the things we were able to do and why we did start in a basement. This is just fact. We've talked to some people that, you know, probably bamboozled us. We've been bamboozled, I think it's fair to say.
Several times.
I mean, I also think it's fair to say, like, we've been bamboozled, but there are reasons to think we sniffed it out a little bit. Like, we were really uncomfortable with certain people, and it proved to be, like, the vibes being bad were indicative of, like, bad stuff. Yeah. I think that's fair to say. So tonight we're going to sort of reflect upon the history of the podcast through some commentary. This is like the old DVD. You know, when you get the DVD, you would get the producer,
and
the writer.
Yeah, the movie, and then you'd have two people talking.
Yeah, it'd be like, this is what we did. Remember we did that? People are like, they love it. And some people love it, some people don't. It's fair enough. Medina said she was a little bit skeptical of a clip show, she called it. But I think it's also fair to say that if it's bad, it was originally Bill's idea. Yeah. I think it's fair to say that. We all saw that. So anyway, folks, let's do a little walk down memory lane. So I guess we got to start in the original studio, I suppose. Now there's a couple ways we sort of talked about doing this. We have what I like to consider like a proto-anti-Przicki, like an early sort of anti-Przicki episode.
Yes.
And we also have sort of a wild sort of an episode that didn't finish. It's probably our only episode that actually does not have a complete an ending.
There's another couple, but they're all early on.
Yeah. So which one?
All of them involve alcohol.
Well, I mean,
once we switch over to more I mean, people still drink in here, but I don't think we've had anybody go completely off the rails since the pandemic.
Yeah, so we have there's a couple. We're just going to call them juvenilia. You know, we're trying. We're making our way. Even, you know, I think it's fair to say this. I'm going to say this before we play. Are we going to do like one of the Przicki ones?
Yeah.
One of the anti-Przicki ones. So I remember that here's what I remember about it. There was an op-ed in Delaware Online about like people are just like yelling at Przicki for no reason. This was like early on. This was probably like 4 years ago.
This was like, yeah, very beginning of 2019.
Very beginning of 20,
very early.
Very early on. So, yeah, I guess 5 years ago, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, 5 years ago.
Over five.
And so we were on the anti-Brzezicki train early. But we tried to do a lot there, but I don't know. Let's just see where we were at. If you're a follower of Highlands Bunker, you understand that what's been going on in Wilmington is of great concern to me and people who share the political beliefs I do. And there's been more scrutiny lately about what's actually going on in the city. The old Al Sporting Goods has been torn down, and BPG will put another building there. Al still exists, obviously, in the new building, but I mean, what does that mean? Bardea has replaced Kennedy's Fried Chicken on Market Street, and I got to be honest with you, as a foodie, I'm going to tell you, Bardea's overrated. That's what I'm going to tell you. It's okay. I mean, it's fine for what it is, but I'd rather eat fried chicken, to be perfectly honest with you. So what's happening in the city? People are very happy. They want all the luxuries of a gated pool community. And that's, you know, they don't really care how we get it. And so that's the moral of this story. We can incent people to make money to improve this city for people who want a Starbucks or a Chick-fil-A. Or we can improve it for everyone. And we don't need to force out or terrorize people who just, you know, they can't work at a bank. You know, they don't have a law degree from Widener. So that, you know, we should be taking care of these people.
All right. So I just want to talk about this. It is a very well-known fact that Brzezicki won because of the fact he got a bunch of Republicans to switch to the Democratic primary. He does not represent what the entire city wants. He won with 23% of the vote. We should have never allowed that to happen. But here it is. He is the mayor right now, and we need to hold him accountable. So I'm sorry that now that you're a Democrat, you don't like what Democrats do because we don't stand for his vision, but guess what? You wanted to join this party. So if you don't like it, leave, go back to whatever party you were with. Most likely you were a part of the Republican Party and you weren't disenfranchised. The fact is, there's always been a Republican or a third party candidate who's run against the mayor for the last 15 years since you've been here. You haven't been here that long. But don't sit here and say that this is, you know, you're proud to switch, because you're not. You're literally giving us Republican talking points. You literally sound like Donald Trump in this op-ed. The fact that you think you have the audacity to come in and say that you're doing this for our better schools and have a better community while pushing the people who have lived here for decades out.
For generations.
For generations. We have people who have, Wilmington is all they know. They were born in Wilmington Hospital or St. Francis Hospital. They their families grew up here. They grew up 11th Street Bridge, South Bridge, or one of the neighborhoods. They don't know anything else. They went to the neighborhood schools when we did have neighborhood schools. They remember being bussed out to white schools out in the county. The thing is, this is not representative of what we want right now. And for you to sit here and write this op-ed about the injustices being done to Mayor Brzezicki shows just how out of touch you are with the city. So, yes, Jessica, if you have such a problem, leave. I'm sorry, leave.
I just want to point out one thing. What Kobe just articulated is the bunker mindset. This is why we're here in the shadow of Rockford Tower, in the bunker, in the Highlands. Because this fucking neighborhood is exactly what Kobe just explained. If it wasn't for Republicans changing, or independents changing to become Democrats to vote for this fucking goober, empty-headed fucking BPG goober, we wouldn't be in this fucking situation. So our time at the original bunker was brief. The funny thing is I get to kind of repeat the story because when people come over to the new studio, it's actually upstairs. And so people ask, like, oh, I thought the bunker was in like this was in a basement. And I said, well, it was at one time. Our friend who I think was on the 100th episode, Bert Manitz, he was able to have us set up in his basement for a period of time. But we had a very early sort of activist roundtable. And this is going to come to a shock to some of you, but the round table consisted of these. Kirsten Walther, who we know, that's our comrade and friend. Stephanie Heron, who I think was the person who introduced me to Maria Beauchamp, who we're going to talk about later. And Kristen Bricker, who was very, very funny in this episode and actually was the person who I think put me over the top. Carl was there.
I think Margaret was there, too.
And Margaret was there as well. So this is a good one to talk about because, like, everybody was there. We'll give Margaret a shout-out in a minute, but, yeah, it was a mess. And again, this one sort of it got us evicted by the landlady, which I think was perfectly fair. Man, I was wondering as it was happening. I was like, now. Does that sound like wine? I see her pouring the wine, but I was like, man, that sounds like a pretty strong piss. Like I'm making.
Imagine if you just had like a grate in the middle of the floor here. Like you're just like, please, like, can we drill the piss grate in? We need it. Like the efficiency it'll create for podcasting will be like just incredible. Turned it. But yeah, I mean, I think like we're probably on agreement that DC, like, so if you want to be a credible presidential candidate in the Democratic Party, then you should be pushing statehood for DC, mm-hmm. like, period.
So is that going to be a mainline deal?
Yes, it should be. Yes, I mean, why wouldn't you? And like, I mean, they are right to claim taxation without representation, and like. It would be objectively good for the Democrats. I mean, I know that, like, the Democrats are not very smart as a political party and tend to not act in their own self-interests and maybe even don't want to because I think the party leadership's aims are very different than the average Democrat voter's aims. But, like, yeah, I mean, that's two more Senate seats that you will pretty much automatically pick up. Like, why are you not pushing for that?
Hello everyone, this is Carl the producer, jumping in real quick. Shortly after this part of the podcast, someone spilled wine all over the floor, and unfortunately order was never quite regained, and a ending was never really recorded, so thanks for listening, left is best, and we'll try to get a little bit less drunk next time. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so we moved studios, which was sort of a big move because where we put it took a lot of like planning and sort of setup and stuff. And so we moved it along, and lo and behold, the second live interview we did was with someone that some people knew. And they were just, they didn't think this guy was a fringe. He was like a fringe, like, I guess you would say, like, internet guy. It was like a poster. And they were mad. They were like, who is this Eric Morrison? What? Who is he? And yeah, he I don't know if you guys know this, but he's in the House of Representatives now, the state. So that's what he's doing. I remember doing this one because we couldn't really talk about the fact he was running. He was getting ready to announce within, you know, like weeks of this, maybe a month or two. And he was working it out with his with his full-time job, and he was doing all the things you need to do, you know, before you run. So we didn't even really talk about it. But I think we were on to something. So here's the final question. I'm scared. I don't think I'm speaking out of school to say that you have political ambitions. Mm-hmm. Am I speaking out of school to say
no,
that?
No, you're definitely okay. Not.
So, I think this is known. If you'd like to make any official announcement here, we would skyrocket. Our literally dozens would move into, we might get like 100 if you just do it.
There is nothing I can announce today, unfortunately. I will say there is something right now that is very, Carl and I were talking about it, but there's something a little bit unexpected right now that's holding me up. I'm hoping to get that resolved. It's something I wasn't expecting. I do, of course, have a political page up. We're just under 1,000 likes. Maybe this broadcast will help us get over that.
Well, it's fucking social media. That's what we do.
But I do.
I don't even know what we do.
But if you had told me 4 years ago I was even considering running for office, I would have told you were crazy. You know, and this is something that I think is really funny. You know, when I first told my parents, my mother specifically, that I was thinking of running for political office, the first thing she said to me, and she was genuinely upset, she said, "Don't do that. You're too honest." And I laughed. And then I thought, that's a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, I put that on a – Carl can figure out how to put that on a sign to make it look real nice, with a nice font and color scheme. He's about fonts and color schemes.
But that's what people don't get, man, is it's like – first of all, that shows people are so jaded that they think there are no good elected officials out there, which I can kind of understand, but there are, and we need to support them. But second of all, that's exactly the point, is that we need, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but, you know, we need people. We need, as and I'll say who it was. It was Representative Kim Williams who said to me, we need people in office who are in the office for the right reasons.
So you heard it here first. I would say about a 40% endorsement that Eric will be challenging John Carney for governor of Delaware.
No, that's not, no. I'm not starting that big.
Yeah, so we kept it moving in the new studio. We talked to Drew Series. I don't know if you know, he's done a lot of great things. We've talked to Sarah McBride. I have a copy, a signed copy of her book. She was here in the studio. Now she's, you know, getting ready to be coronated. The Pope will come, but she'll crown herself as Napoleon did. But one thing we did from the studio that was, kind of a first for us, and I remember like the vibe once we hung up was, there was a movement in Puerto Rico to oust the governor there due to sort of like neoliberal sort of suspicious activities, you know, kind of like corruption, basically. And we were able to hook up via Skype with Wilmington's own Maria Beauchamp and talk to her when she was in San Juan, in the street protesting this after a week of sort of uprising in Puerto Rico. And we spoke with her, and we felt great about it. And later that evening, the governor stepped down. So it was a cool night in the studio. Yes, I did hear yesterday that the police are involved They're looking into all of these messages and all of the messages and the leaks. What's the next step? What do we feel like? You feel like there's going to be some sort of inquiry announced or charges brought? What are you guys demanding right now?
So we are demanding several things. We definitely want the resignation or the impeachment of the governor. That is for sure. We also want every single person involved in the administration, in the chat, all the employees, all of the contracts to be investigated. But we also want the junta, the oversight committee, to be looked into. We want them out next. This entire process of how the oversight committee was put into Puerto Rico was actually an illegal process. We took that to court, and a court in Boston actually said that it was unconstitutional, but it's now the Supreme Court and everything is on hold. So the oversight budget committee is still here doing whatever they want to do, and we want them out next.
That's great. You know what? I appreciate you reaching out to us. I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to let you do what you need to do, but I'm going to ask you to stay safe, and we'll be in touch with you, okay?
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Love from Puerto Rico. Nos vamos.
Yeah, solidarity.
Thank you very much.
We also did our first, I'm pretty sure this was our first, on-location one.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So there was some sort of Democratic, state Democratic Party, like Black Caucus, maybe.
Yeah.
At Chelsea Tavern, in the.
It was Kobe Owens that put it together.
Yeah. It was Kobe, and they were gonna watch like the primary presidential debate, and it was the first evening that I met Medina in person. And we interviewed a bunch of different people, but at the end, there was like a Trump like reactionary guy at the bar upstairs that Kobe, I guess, saw, and the guy asked him what's going on downstairs, and he said it was a Democratic Black Caucus thing, and so he wandered down, and I talked to him for like 20 minutes. So yeah, this is something we reference every once in a while. I guess maybe we can link to the whole conversation, but this is a little bit of it. So we've located a gentleman's come up from upstairs, I think. John? You want to give your last name or no?
Just John.
Just John's fine. And it's come to our attention that we might have sort of a right-wing guy, a Trump guy. So did you just wander down and see what was going on?
Yeah, I came over here not knowing what was going on. I was upstairs, and I was told that there was a viewing party going on, so I came down to check it out. I like politics in general, so I just came down, and I came to give it a view, and that's how I ended up here.
So what was your takeaway? I mean, how'd you feel just about the scene watching the debate and all that?
Well, again, as a Trump supporter, I came away pretty happy about what I saw. I thought it was a lot of really crazy, off-the-wall, left-wing stuff that a lot of independents aren't going to support. There is one person I'm a little bit worried about, but I don't think she's going to weather the Democrat primary. So It's not going to matter in the end.
So what do you think is crazy about it? What do you think is crazy about it?
They're talking about buying guns back. That they're this mandatory buyback program that are guns that were never owed to the government in the first place. So it's like they bought these guns from a third party party. And now the government's going to say that we're going to buy your guns back, which was never owed to the government in the first place. I just don't understand. It's almost the whole reason the Second Amendment was put into place is so that we could have our own militia, and now they're going to be buying back guns that aren't owed to them. So I find that bizarre.
Do you think that the government has the legal right to decide what should be out in the street, whether it's guns, like not just guns, but like drugs, what kind of cars. Like, for example, like, there's certain kind of cars. Like, you can't make a car anymore without seatbelts, right? Mm-hmm. That's against the law. And there's lots of things like that that you used to be able to get things that were sort of dangerous, mm-hmm. and now you can't get them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you think that that's an appropriate application of democratic government?
I do, in the sense of what you're saying. I think that there should be a grandfather law that we could, in a sense, no longer sell automatic weapons to individuals, but I don't think that we should enact a mandatory buyback program.
Yeah, so around this time, I met a woman, Margaret Hugh, who came here from Brown, who I met with Kobe going down to Middletown to protest, like, the racist parade that they did. Our friend Photog Jerry was there. Carrie Harris, when she had Good Politics, was there. Yeah, I met Margaret, and she was part of the team. She helped produce a bunch of episodes. She helped. She was working in client services and just, you know, helped us a lot. And yeah, here's a little bit of, if you remember the Margaret days, here's a little bit of Margaret. Because I don't know how long you had been here when we first met. I've told the story before. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's gotten out before, but, you know, I wanted to go down. Carrie asked me to come down to this Middletown thing after the racist float at the parade, and to this the city council meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So Kobe said he would drive. We're going to go down and meet Carrie. And you were in the car. I'm like, oh, we're going down with somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's why Kobe's like, oh, he's starting a podcast. You were like, excuse me, what?
Faithful car ride.
Yeah.
But you were like, I don't know how to use Logic Pro. And I was like, I don't use Logic Pro.
Yeah. I was like, I don't know anything. If it wasn't for you two guys, we wouldn't even be doing this right now. But you have to meet people where they are. We talked about that all the time, politics, but you do it in your work. Like, you don't impute, like, need or assume what somebody's situation is. You know, you say, okay, what's happening? Sort of where are you at? And, like, what's the best way for me to spend my time to meet your most crucial need today, or you know, your second most crucial tomorrow, whatever. And I think most people who do are just like that. And I'm so glad that you're doing this, because it just shows people that I'm right. And I love to be proven right.
Yeah, and it's a very simple thing. And I think when I think privilege, again, I think, you know, privilege shouldn't be as uncomfortable or scary thing to talk about as it, like, kind of is this, like, discomfort thing. Because I think what it boils down to is privilege allows you to, like, it is the gift of not having to deal with or see certain things. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's why I'm always trying to check myself with the ones I have. I think I emphasize this again and again, because I think, as you know, I live a life where, because of certain identities I hold, like being Asian and being someone who's, like, queer, I think there are multiple experiences I have where I know someone's trying to define my narrative for me. And so I think with everything I do that I think is justice oriented, I was like, I never want to do that to someone else. And you know, I think we all make mistakes, and that happens sometimes. But I think, you know, I think I take my role as an advocate, as my job, like, very seriously. It's like, I always want to just basically have a healthy relationship with my clients and anyone I'm fighting for, and be like, this should be open communication. Like, you should be telling me, like, what you want, and, like, I should be amplifying your voice and advocating for you faithfully. And if I'm, you know, and that should be a constant conversation for that reason.
So the next big sort of transition was all on Zoom. COVID hit. People, like, don't want to sort of remember the time, but it was quite harrowing. So we moved to Zoom, and we did some activism. And then, right as that was happening, we went out in the street. And, You know, it was significant. It's always going to be significant. Of course, it didn't work again, but it's important stuff. And we not only did we do that, we reflected on that by speaking with Professor Peter Levy from York about the Great Uprising book that he wrote, which talks about uprisings in the 60s in small towns and big cities, York, Cambridge, and Baltimore. And yeah, it was a real time to like focus my mind. So here we go. Comrades, friends, and neighbors, solidarity. I hope you and yours are healthy and safe. We're coming to you from the hermetically sealed bunker once again, with a special sort of crisis edition. We have a crisis situation here. You can ignore it, but it really can't be escaped. And unlike climate change, it's acute and it's happening now. And we all better sort of kind of get our heads around it and figure out how we're going to help our neighbors and how we're going to help our community and try to get through it. I am happy to have on the line doing we're social distancing by a couple of neighborhoods, Dana and Adam from Food Not Bombs in Wilmington.
Hey, what's up?
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
And I've been sitting in my house looking out my window. We live over in Eastside, and speaking of like systemic issues and things, I'm really worried about this community and the poorer people in our city. People are still out and about. All the kids are out of school. And I don't know that people understand what's happening. And I know that in like 2 weeks, we're going to have a lot of cases in these areas that maybe aren't being confirmed because a lot of people just don't have access to even just like basic healthcare. So going to get a test is like really beyond what they're going to be able to do.
A far-fetched idea.
But I mean, we've got a lot of elderly people here. We've got a lot of very poor people without access to good healthcare. And I'm worried. I'm really worried. Very concerned. I mean, and then there's like branching out from that, something that I've been thinking about a lot is like, what is it going to look like with a bunch of kids home, no money coming in for anybody? Presumably, I think that like we're going to start seeing some tensions and hopefully not, but maybe violence and things happening just because of how desperate it's going to get. So what are we doing now to be proactive to stop that from happening? And don't tell me you're going to send a bunch of cops in. Like, what are you going to do to feed people? What are you going to do to keep them in their houses? What are you going to do to get them medical care? Because I'm worried about this community.
I just was taking a walk in the neighborhood and, you know, a few, you know, police academy washouts and tactical gear are, you know, defending the fucking bottles of Absolut and the lottery shop down the street, you know, wannabe Navy SEALs. Really, I'm incensed that people do not understand what seems to be a very basic premise. The people vandalizing and looting live here. Their families are here. The businesses, large and small, rarely benefit them. The jobs on offer are exploitative and for poverty wages. The gentrified property values make housing unaffordable. And the adhesive that holds all of this together are the armed officers that protect private property, the police. Yesterday, we marched from Rodney Square. We marched to 8th and French. We marched down to the police station and did a big action there as a second group from 8th and French looped all the way around and brought people down 4th Street. when they joined us from 4th Street, there was a large action at the police station. And then after some back and forth with the police and some folks getting pulled in, possibly arrested, some things getting broken up, the police sort of the confrontation there wasn't going to go anywhere. So we walked down Walnut, over to Walnut Street Bridge into South Bridge.
And we blocked traffic on Walnut Street for about a half hour. Nothing really of consequence there. I did see somebody break a red light camera, which everybody can get behind. Now, at this point, I didn't know, and I don't know if other people did know, but after the fact, I was alerted to the fact that at that time, the police had taken cars and, like, encircled the ShopRite, the big ShopRite that's down in Southbridge, because they're, you know, they're going to obviously secure the Capitol. And we didn't go that way. We gave them the old switcheroo, and we cut back through towards the riverfront. And then we deked towards the riverfront and deked back, and we took the highway. And I'm proud of that.
I would say one distinguishing factor, at least, I'm a social psychologist and sociologist and street ethnographer, but I'm not an historian. But so one factor that I think distinguishes, you know, the uprisings and revolts during the 60s, and at least what's happening more recently, you do see a lot of targeting. I guess it depends on what community, but Wilmington's a good example. You do see a lot of rioting and looting more so in downtown sections, right, in whiter, wealthier neighborhoods and communities. I don't think folk are rioting and looting in the suburbs or going to residential homes. That hasn't happened yet. There's been some protests, though, with regard to that. But for the most part, the rioting and the looting, at least on TV, I think there needs to be a systematic analysis of these 140 and 50 cities presently to really see what happened where. But it looks like, and definitely in Wilmington, it wasn't in Black neighborhoods. They were not Black businesses. Yo, this is downtown East Side. This is the corporate white sector of Wilmington that got thrashed. Right, I'm not saying that there might have not been a Black-owned business someplace within that mix, but that is predominantly a white, wealthy business community. And you saw scores of that throughout the country. So something is different. The targeting of the rioting and looting is different. Now, not to say that folks sat around and had some calculated plan. I think, you know, I agree with Dr. Levy. You know, it's important to really characterize and put everything in a proper frame. So, right, and I think there's variability, there's variation. You have different groups, different competing forces. But if we're talking about those young folk that are out there that are just running around and angry, no, it's not as calculated. It still may be in some way now a spiritual or holy act, right, from the perspective of the folk in the community, or righteous or justified act. But it's not necessarily thought out in terms of a step-by-step, blow-by-blow kind of way. It's very organic. The rage is very organic.
So early on, we were having great conversations. Actually, one from the original bunker was with Lex about all the work he did to cover the Smyrna prison uprising. And we talked to tons and tons of people that wrote stories or that were working in media. But then we did one that really got us sort of banned from ever speaking to basically any reporter ever again. And I think once again, it's about Mike Brzezicki. Jeannie and Jerry reported a story in late August titled "How a Wilmington Affordable Housing Project Created to Serve the City's Lowest Earners Was Lost." I know that reporters and photographers don't write the headlines, so I won't waste time on a long critique other than to say that headline is total dog shit. My headline would be more like Mayor Brzezicki and Deputy Rago hate poor people. Some might find this commentary outlandish or incendiary, but after reviewing this reporting, I guess you can sort of tell me. Jeannie, so late 1990s, there's a deal cut, as many were, to build affordable housing, and Quaker Village was born. So you want to give us the sort of the background on the building and sort of the first years that it was sort of established?
Sure. Well, first of all, I did have some hand in writing that headline, and I just want to say that I do not endorse Rob's.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at this overall like, you know, it's commodification of one of the things that probably can't be commodified. I mean, that's how we started the conversation. It's like, okay, well, you can't make a profit at helping poor people, okay? I mean, it's sort of like the conversation we have with healthcare. Well, you know, maybe, you know, what kind of profit margins do you want to put in there for people's, like, cancer treatment or life or death or coronavirus treatment or whatever, what have you? I think, you know, that's the commentary from the reporting that I took away from it. And, you know, I know you're not going to make any comment about that, or I won't mention anybody else by name, just so you don't feel uncomfortable. You really did help write that headline, though. Garbage. Terrible.
I do have to come up. I do have to have some input in them occasionally.
So one of the funny things that happened, you know, we'll get to the Kathy v. Kathy stuff, but one of the funny things that happened online before that was that we sniffed out like a sock puppet account, and here's the only thing I'll say. If Ben DuPont ever runs for governor, it's going to be very funny for this podcast. So did the account on Twitter, Sarah Benedict Duguid, appear before or after Jess's campaign?
During,
well,
right?
It was before. So
it was there.
Yeah, Sarah Benedict Duguid created her account in 2013, and I don't know if maybe there were some other posts and just the tweets had been wiped, or if, like, Sarah had not tweeted at all prior to summer. It was like July or something of 2019, but she made a tweet that was like my first tweet, you know, one of those like intro tweets that older people like to do when they join Twitter. And Sarah's photo was of a blonde woman with glasses and heavily heavily lined eyes. Like, her bio was something like, mom, advocate, wife, new to Twitter.
You know, she pretended that she was an RN at the Ellesmere VA.
Oh, wait, hospital. She did?
Yeah.
See, before me. That's before my... Yeah. I don't remember that.
Well, initially she said she was a teacher because she was harassing one of the, like, DSEA folks that I'm not going to name in case they don't want me to, but, like... Because initially, one of the reasons that Sarah popped up in summer of 2019 on my radar was because this person from education circles had DM'd me and was like, okay, Sarah claims to be a teacher right now. She wasn't a nurse yet. And but, like, there's no teacher in Delaware named Sarah Benedict Duguid. Like, I've gone through the roles. This person does not exist. And I'm not sure who it is, but they keep harassing me. And I was like, oh, interesting. Okay, good to know. But... I didn't have any leads, so I kind of just filed that under weird, funny things on Twitter, but, like, didn't think much more of it. But then, yeah, Sarah loved to reply to Jess, loved to quote tweet Jess. Also, Kyle Evans Gay, really interestingly, was sold on the idea that Kyle Evans Gay was, quote, radical Antifa.
Well, this is about the time I became sort of aware of it.
Yeah.
Because I was, like, you know, like the commie guy. But, like,
Loved to talk to you.
She loved you. Yeah. So she would be like, you know, she lived in Middletown? Was that what
Middletown,
it was?
Yes. Middletown. But all of her, like, when she would post pictures of her weather app, it was it was Wilmington. And when she would post photos of, like, you know, going for a walk at lunch or whatever, it was always Wilmington. Everything was Wilmington. The only thing that was Middletown was her banner, which was just... She pulled it from, like, the Middletown City website or something.
Yeah. But, yeah, so she would do the thing where it's like, well, this is my husband's plumbing business. Like, that was a big move she would do for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny because she said that, like, she hated Bernie. And she was like, Bernie Sanders isn't going to stop with the Waltons. He's going to take my husband's plumbing business, too. He's going to put us out of all our money that we worked so hard for. Like, with Bernie, it was always about the husband's plumbing business.
Yeah.
So funny.
And I was like, at one point, we're going back and forth. Like, I just think it's like, I took it for face value for a minute, especially because, like, I was an older person, number one. Number two, like, I was sort of new to Twitter only a couple years, and I was, like, shitposting and stuff, and I wasn't sure.
And I looked at the handle, and the handle was at BEN and a bunch of numbers.
It was like, yeah, 867539 or something.
Some time passes, and this is also in the dossier.
Yeah, and also during this time, Sarah is producing great tweets. She is, quote, tweeting Jess and saying, Chris Coons is great for working moms like me. She also quote tweets you multiple times and says, please stop mansplaining to me in like weird old person smiley faces.
Yeah, yeah.
She says, like, yeah, she's calling Kyle Evans Gay radical Antifa.
I'm a lifelong Democrat, and like, this is how you lose my vote. Like,
she would say that, literally after that, the next tweet would be like, at Lee Murphy, so many of us are rooting for you. And it's like, Sarah, get your story straight.
And also in the lore, I forget if it's her nephew or son died of a heroin. Ben, if you're listening, that is, I honestly think, thing. Like, that's a serious thing in this world, and you fucking put it on as a character affectation.
Well, Sarah said that she is a listener of the Highlands Bunker podcast when she was tweeting, so I can only assume that she's listening to us right now.
That was just the most disgusting thing, I thought. I don't know. That's like when I got blackpilled that day, I think, when I put this all.
Well,
the
also,
other one was,
like,
it was all the she. So, if you haven't figured out by now, if you didn't listen to us mention it a few other times, it's fucking Ben DuPont. So, the fucking best part of this whole persona that shifted over time was the fucking coding. Her nephew or niece went to the coding.
No, well, it's several nephews and all of the sons, because she had a bunch of rowdy boys, and then her sons, and then all of her nephews, except the one nephew, did not go to the coding school. And is
fentanyl.
Yes. Like, what kind of fucked up thing is that, where you're saying that one who didn't choose the coding school died of an overdose?
Yeah. The whole thing was just incredible. So about the time, this was a little bit, I had to check I have to go back in the archives to figure this out. But at some point then, after exchanging those messages with Carl, I sent a DM to Sarah Benedict Duguid, and I was like, "You're fake, right?" I was like, "You're because that's also in the dossier," and I was like, "You're fucking putting this on." And of course, I never got a response to it. But like, after I did that, within 6 months, like I started treating that account different. Like I think we all started to be like, "Something's up with this."
Yeah,
and then it kind of went from there, but. But I had it. I fucking had it.
But yeah, eventually, like, so we all were wondering who this person was. And
wait, was this also before or after, like, the 2020 primary?
This was after. This was December 2020.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember.
December 2020. And then, yeah, like, Sarah had replied to me, like, a week later after I made a stupid joke about, like, can't wait to use my stimulus check for my first semesters of textbooks at Ben DuPont's Coding Academy. And then, and then like a week after that, I get like Sarah Benedict Duguid telling me that actually if you make under a certain amount, the tuition is free. And I was like, why does this woman care? Like, okay, I need to look into this because I need to know. It's the holidays. I don't have anything better to do. So I start looking in and I'm like, okay, it finally clicked that like, yeah, this account Sarah retweets Ben DuPont a lot is clearly like searching for the Coding Academy to defend its honor. The handle is Ben bunch of numbers. I was like, holy shit, I bet this is Ben DuPont's burner account. So I like reverse.
Very usual suspects moment at the end.
Yeah, it was. Like, yeah, I reverse image searched the profile picture and found out that it came from a story about a woman who allowed her son to store weapons in his bedroom, and then the son ended up planning a mass shooting and didn't go through with it. Like, they caught it before he went through with it. But so it's a really grim story, out of state. I have no idea how. So it's like, okay, clearly the picture is fake. Ben bunch of numbers, obsessed with Ben DuPont's Coding Academy. I was looking at the follows and comparing them, like who Sarah follows versus who Ben DuPont follows. Very similar. A lot of like Chris Kenny connections, his business partner. Pattern of the things that the Sarah account and the Ben account would fave was very similar, because they both have this really chaotic energy in the tweets they fave, where, like, you get the sense of their ideology that it's bad and that it's right-wing and not good, but, like, there's also things thrown in there that you're like, okay, this doesn't jive with your worldview. Like, I don't understand what you're thinking here, you know, in faving, like, I don't know, like, it, but it was the same kind of chaotic energy, basically.
So now, again, Kirsten's laying it out like the last scene of fucking The Usual Suspects. And we're like, oh my God, it's fucking Kaiser Soze. And I guess you, Bill, you had sent me, when you sent me the article of the woman that I guess you found that was embroiled in this, her son had the gun and all that. And I clicked the link and pulled the article up. And I'm like, motherfucker. Because I was like, that's her. And I don't know how long it took you to do it, but like, you're like, I'm screenshotting everything. I got this. She's like, yeah. 30%, 50%. That was good. Because we were all getting ready to like blow it up on social media. I sent him an email. I'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But like, we wanted to make sure we had.
Well, he denied it at first. Do you remember?
Yes.
He responded to, I think, both of you guys.
Yeah.
And was like,
he's like, no.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
But yeah, that. So I find the email, and I don't know if it's going to work or not again. I just, he's at some company, some financial bullshit banking institution or legal firm or whatever he's working at. So I shoot this email off, but it's just like, hey, buddy, I think we got you. And I'm like, I gave him like just I was like, boom, boom, boom. I'm like, I said, I understand how embarrassing this must be for you. Like that whole, I gave him the whole deal. And literally, I sent it. I put a read receipt on it. Within 5 minutes, it got read. Mm-hmm. And then the Twitter account went down like maybe 10 seconds after that.
Yep.
We're refreshing. And I just remember texting you, Kirsten, and I was like, did you get it all? She's like, I got it all. And I knew. I was like, I knew we had everything. So now's the time to sort of mention the largest project and the sort of the project that sort of was the most followed, I guess we'll say. It was October. Was it what you said? It was October of
October 2021.
October of 2021. Delaware auditor Kathy McGinnis was indicted on 5 charges, and we had sort of been tracking it again just as a sort of funny internet goof about what her brand was and what she was doing at a state level elected sort of office. Bill and I went down to the courthouse, and we went to the press conference. And after the press conference, we kind of did a blood brother fellowship that we would follow the trial, or follow it if it went to trial. And little did we know that there would be a trial, and the trial would not be in Wilmington. But here's a few clips from that saga.
Hi there, Delaware State Auditor Kathy McGinnis here. In 2019, when I took over this office, I hired an outside firm that had never done business with this office to actually audit the auditor's office. They had 58 findings and recommendations, and I'm proud to tell you, here in June of 2020, we have addressed, resolved, and fixed those 58 recommendations.
Beginning more than a year ago, our office received a number of whistleblower reports alleging misconduct by State Auditor Kathleen McGinnis. An intensive investigation followed, and that investigation is still ongoing. That investigation has involved extensive witness interviews, thousands of document reviews, and countless hours of work by our Division of Civil Rights and Public Trust. The investigation has confirmed a clear and a disturbing pattern of behavior that was not only unethical, but it was against the law.
We were somewhere around Leipzig, on the edge of Bombay Hook, when the rifts, bits, spoofs, and goofs began to take hold. I remember my attorney saying something like,
GM Robert, I'll characteristically be running 10 minutes late. Maybe you should drive?
And suddenly there was a terrible roar all around us, and the sky was full of what looked like winged former deputy auditors, all swooping and screeching and diving around our Swedish suburban utility vehicle, which earlier was going exactly 45 miles per hour in that Wilmington I-95 construction zone where I'm sure I'm about to sideswipe a concrete lane divider, to Dover. And a voice was screaming,
Holy Jesus! Confidentiality!
Then it was quiet again. My attorney had taken off both shoes and one sock and was pouring Mio water enhancer on his chest to facilitate the tanning process.
What the hell are you yelling about?
He muttered, staring over towards the motor speedway with his eyes closed and covered with wraparound Greek sunglasses. Never mind, I said. It's your turn to drive. I hit the brakes and I aimed the valve towards the shoulder of Route 1. No point in mentioning those flying whistleblowers, I thought. This poor bastard will see them soon enough.
Is there anything you would have done differently, looking back at it now?
I would have ensured some people kept better paperwork. The folks that were in charge of certain things. But again, we have different people who have different skill sets, and I think we're on a really great path right now with the team we have.
We were half an hour late, and the Delta 9, purchased with promo code COMETOWN20, was just sneaking up. We knew Sean O'Sullivan couldn't continue to hold our seats forever.
Yeah, so it goes without saying that we want to thank people who have come in and talked to us on multiple occasions and have just been, like, basically part of our comrades and friends, right? You know, Kowalko, been in many times. Medina, been in many times. And also, I want to thank Harvey J.K. He's been on probably three or four times. He's been very, very nice with his time to talk about Thomas Paine, to talk about the New Deal and the Four Freedoms, to talk about old school sort of socialism and Gramsci, and to give me like a to sort of settle me in my historical place. And so I really appreciate that. I mean, we've had other historians on. We've had Richard White about Reconstruction. We've had Dale Norwood about, you know, and that's a thing that we do often. But big shout out to Harvey J.K. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of hope on that side, on like you know, with the executive branch and relating it to what FDR was able to do. But let's wrap it up with a little bit of hope. There's been a wave of strikes.
Thank you.
Is that what you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say that and something related to it. First of all, the media has done a very utterly disgustingly inadequate job of covering this resurgence of labor activism and organizing and striking. Okay. And this tells us that that American workers have finally reached, they're up against the wall, you might say. The pandemic was that force that really drove it. We had the makings of this for some time. It didn't come out of nowhere. You had the fight for 15. You had the teacher strikes in West Virginia and other states. You had the organizing of a more dynamic labor union for teachers in Chicago. I mean, we could name the various examples. And even though it failed, the union organizing drive down in Alabama really did send a signal to the rest of the country. And I can only imagine, I don't know for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that elsewhere in the Amazon jungle, that others are organizing too. And last but not least, one of my favorite students graduated 5-6 years ago, became an organizer with the National Nurses Union. And I can tell you, she has a 1,000 batting average in the organizing that she has helped to lead around the country at hospitals. It's astounding. These women are ready to organize and, if necessary, to act. Okay, so we're living in very, very promising times. The problem is, of course, that the Republicans may win back the House in 2022. They could possibly win back the presidency. However, that kind of organizing, if workers are organized, then there's only so many things that the Republicans will dare to do. It is really important. As you may have seen on Twitter, I keep saying, no labor, no left. No left or labor, no democracy. So this is that really important moment. The other thing I was going to say is, if perhaps Joe Biden is a closet listener to Hyland's Bunker, then just maybe he'll have heard you and me, speak of FDR, okay? And it will awaken in him the sense of, even if I can't get exactly what I want, if I can get my team of the cabinet, the Congress, if I can get these folks out to agitate in favor of a liberal, social democratic, progressive, I don't care what you want to call it, agenda, then maybe we can make enough of an impression on working people that they'll bother to turn out to vote in 2022 and vote Democratic. In other words, it's not like he had to win everything. He had to show that he was prepared to empower people. That's, to me, the key thing. That's what FDR did. I mean, labor was ready to support FDR because he had signed in 1933 an act that had afforded them the opportunity to organize. The later NLRA is when he made what he had done in 1933 all the more effective with the leadership and assistance of Robert Wagner. And that's what's missing in this administration, okay? Not just vision. The vision is Bernie's in some ways, the better part of it. But they're lacking the understanding that they have to trust their fellow citizens. They have to empower and encourage, even incite their fellow citizens. You know, I think it was Frederick Douglass, nothing is won without a struggle.
So one of the big ones that wound up sort of kicking off a movement that we're doing that's actually still ongoing to this very day about the sort of secret corporate cabal that runs the corporate code. But the way that all kind of kicked off was my interest in speaking to Hal Weitzman, who was a Financial Times editor and journalist, and who was currently, I think he still is, the editor of the Chicago Business School Booth Review Journal. But he wrote a book called What's the Matter with Delaware, about the franchise. We talk about it a lot, but we talked to him with a guy you might know, historian Dale Norwood. But here's a little bit of that. I do want, before we end, for you to give us a review of how the Corporation Law Council operates, how it operates with the legislature. And also, I was happy to read the passage about our hero, John Kowalko. He's retiring this year, and we call him our representative emeritus. But he had a back and forth with Melanie George Smith several years ago about trying to have some sort of democratic oversight on the statute changes that were submitted by the secret council. Could you talk about that a little bit and sort of what you took from that and also what your impression of Kowalko was, because he is our big hero over here.
Yeah, well, I thought he was great. I mean, I have to say everyone I met in Delaware was great. And I include in that Jeff Bullock, who was very friendly and open to meeting me, and his office were very cooperative. They did not withhold any information from me anyway. And everybody else I met with, who, whether they support the system or don't, I thought was terrific. And John Kowalka was one of the people I was pleased to meet and kept in touch with a little bit over the years. And I was just very disappointed to see that he's decided to retire. But of course, he deserves it. He's been a lone voice, hasn't he?
He has.
I want to hear from you guys, actually, but maybe we can do this after the podcast, about, because you have a whole load of new sort of liberal radical legislators. I want to hear if they either are interested or could be made interested in this topic, because it would be a tragedy to let the issue kind of rest because John Kowalka is no longer in the state house. But I can tell you the story if you want to.
Yeah, I will tell you this: the new wave of sort of more radical, I would say it's more the latter. I don't think that they're necessarily keen on it today, but they could be made to feel keen. I think, and in their, they don't need to be defended, but in their defense, I think most of the issues that they focus on, because it's a part-time legislature and they don't have a lot of time, are sort of more material community issues that come up. And this obviously is a sort of an esoteric structure. I think that probably helps with the management of it. But I definitely think that there are people coming along who, and people have said it on this podcast, who Kowalka has inspired, has mentored, and we're getting more of them elected. So there is a possibility that some of these issues could be ameliorated in some way. So thanks for listening, everyone. Like I said, I remember sitting with Carl at my dining room table about 6 years ago being like, hey, so I want to do something that's like a combination of Chapo Trap House and the Delaware Liberal blog. It's like, I don't even know what that could possibly be. But I'm encouraged. Super producer Carl has fucking killed it getting something out every week. Because it's not easy to do this. Like, I challenge some people to do it. Some people have tried to do it when they hear how good this is, and they can't do it. So, you know, that's just a fact. But I really appreciate the people who do get it. I appreciate the people who continue to get it. I hope you guys enjoy our 300th episode next week. I think you will. And I just want to leave you with this. We've always been really big on trying to draw people's attention to people who need who need justice. We used to say Lula Livre before we said left is best. Yaheem Harris, we were huge sort of supporters behind that movement, and we got him released. But one of the biggest movements, as you guys know, is the movement for freedom of the Palestinians right now. It's, you know, we've said everything we need to say, and we'll say more of it, but we need to continue to show international solidarity with people who are living, not only in Gaza, living under just brutal terrorism and genocide, starvation, all of that, but even in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank, South Lebanon even. But I want to close this episode with a poem by Maya Abu al-Hayat. Maya is a teacher and an intellectual and a poet. From Palestine. Carl and I were humbled and grateful to be able to host her here in the studio through just odd means. A shout out to Philip at the DSA. He helped us put that together. But it was really something, and we had a long conversation, and it ended with her reciting a beautiful poem that she wrote. 1 week after we released that was October 7th. And while I was able to continue to communicate with Maya for a few months afterwards, I haven't been any time here in 2024. And if there's anything that should focus your mind about anything, it's solidarity with people here in Delaware, in the United States, and abroad. And keep the Palestinians in your mind. All right. So we're going to leave you here after the 299th episode with the words of Maya. Left is best. But I did read this one poem. I enjoyed it because it was about hope and the phobia of hope. But I also think it would be cool to listen to it as it was meant to be received. So if it's okay, I was going to read it in English and then have you read it in Arabic, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Well, I'll go. Let's see. I suffer a phobia called hope. Each time I hear that word, I recall the disappointments that were committed in its name. The children who don't return, the ailments that are never cured, the memory that's never senile, all of them hope crushed beneath its wings. As I smash this mosquito on my daughter's head. The grieving have only the unknown. It's their only staple and inheritance. Pain has no logic. All things redeem the grieving except your rational questions. I wish that no one goes and no one comes. All going is a stroke of myth, and each return a punctured lung.
مصابة بفوبيا اسمها الأمل. كلما سمعت هذه المفردة استرجعت كل الخيبات التي ارتكبت باسمه، الأبناء الذين لا يعودون، الأوجاع التي لا تشفى، الذاكرة التي لا تشيخ، كلها سحقها الأمل تحت جناحيه كما أسحق البعوضة فوق رأس ابنتي. ليس للفاقد سوى الغيبيات، إنها طعامه وإرثه الوحيد. لا منطق للألم، كل الأشياء تشفع للمحزون إلا سؤالكم المنطقي. ليت أحدا لا يذهب، ليت أحدا لا يعود. كل ذهاب ضرب في الخرافة، كل عودة ثقب في الرئة.